Greetings, Professor Falcon.
Hello, Joshua?
Strange game. The only winning move is not to play. How about a nice game of chess?
Colonel Conley, take us to DEFCON 5.
Yes, sir.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard. Today's guest is Aidan Moher, author of Fight Magic Items, The History of Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, and the Rise of Japanese RPGs in the West. I've followed Aidan online for over 10 years now, so it's so exciting for me to finally get him on the show. So Aidan, you and I have actually followed each other online for, goodness what, 15 years now, since the beginning of the science fiction blogosphere. We were building our followers at the same time, and I vividly remember absolutely physically drooling over the Julie Dillon artwork that you had on your website. We both cut our teeth on book review blogging and talking about the science fiction industry. So I've known you for a long time, but I know many of my listeners maybe haven't. So can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So it has been forever, like a different lifetime, it feels like, right, from those blogging days. So I started a blog in 2007 called A Dribble of Ink, and it was a sci-fi fantasy book blog. It expanded outward into other media, like from there, but it started as a, you know, book blog about science fiction and fantasy. I got, you know, fresh off like a web design degree or certificate program at university. And then I just happened to stumble into some review copies of a Terry Brooks book and a David Anthony Durham book. And I was like, okay, like I need some way to cut my teeth on building websites. I like to talk about books. I was, you know, very active on internet forums and stuff. I was like, and now I have these review copies, like, let's do this. And I was a big fan of some of the other, you know, blogs that had kind of been around at the time. And so I started it, and it took off from there. And it, you know, it was very successful in that space for a number of years until I shut it down in 2015 to sort of carry on to the next phase of my life after having kids and wanting to focus, you know, on different areas of writing and stuff. And then, of course, the blogosphere changed a lot at that time too. So I, you know, I ran it for about 8 years, and it brought me a lot of joy. It connected me with a lot of amazing people that I'm still connected with. And, you know, without that, we wouldn't be here today, I think. Right. And so, you know, Dribble of Ink, it did all sorts of things. It focused on, a lot of guest posts. So I do a lot of editorial work in terms of searching out like people and voices to bring onto the blog and stuff. And it was known for that. And that was a lot of fun and helped kind of set me off towards where I am now, which is, you know, I'm a author, a writer. I have a book that came out in October, which I think we'll talk about today. And then also a games journalist and features writer. So I've worked for places like the Washington Post and Wired and a whole bunch of other places with sort of a focus on the, like, you know, retro gaming. And this is, you know, a retro focused podcast. So a lot of my, you know, topics I write about now are about old games, but it's also about experiencing sort of retro through the modern lens, right? What is it like to play games as an adult that you enjoyed as a child, or you know, how are our experiences with those altered if we, you know, we play something that's 30 years old instead of playing it at the moment? So I write a lot about you know, video games from that perspective, and still cover books here and there, but not as much. I enjoy being able to just read books and not have to think too hard about them nowadays.
Oh gosh, we could spend the next 10 years talking about the early days of the science fiction blogosphere, and I want you on this episode to talk about retro gaming. And I love something you just said about you know, playing games that we played when we were kids, and what's that experience like now. Something that's wonderful for our generation is we can play these games with our kids. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid playing Super Mario Brothers in the 1980s, my parents thought I was crazy. Like, why would you want to spend your time playing that? And now we can enjoy that with our kids. And I just think that's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, after we're done recording, I'm headed straight downstairs to play Pokemon with my my daughter, my 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate to grow up in a house where my dad was he was the first adopter of technology. He loved technology and still does. And so he was constantly supportive of those sorts of things. And he just, I think, like looking back, he just needed any excuse to bring a new game or a new game console into the house. And my mom was similar. She was a big reader, and so that's where like my connection to reading goes all the way back to her. And my house is filled with science fiction fantasy books, but you know, we got my first console was a Game Boy, like the old chunky Game Boy, and like I'm fairly convinced at this point it was because my mom wanted to play Tetris and this Star Trek game. She loves Star Trek. There was a Game Boy game based on Star Trek and she wanted to play it, and I'm pretty sure that's why, you know, like they've got a Game Boy for me, was so that my mom could play those games that she wanted to play. So I grew up in a totally different environment where it was like baked into kind of our family's culture and remains that way. And it's, but it, you know, like you say, it's a joy to now carry that forward with my kids, and watch them experience and enjoy the same things that I do. And I have, you know, like a bunch of old game consoles set up beside me on some old tube TVs, right? And so we're like, you know, we're going back and playing those same games in the same way that I did growing up. And that's interesting as well, because I find kids are not very discerning about stuff like old graphics, right? Like they'll go back and if a game looked good, had nice art style, it doesn't really matter to them. They don't notice that as much as like adult gamers do. And that's something that like books haven't really changed. You pick up a book from the 60s, or you pick up, you know, Lord of the Rings, and it feels of its time, but at the same time, the mechanics are all the same, right? Like you read it and... but video games have changed so much. It's interesting to see and put that sort of technological advancement in front of kids and see how they react.
That is fantastic. I am still looking for a ringtone for my Android. That is the original Tetris music, because I need to just announce my love for the original Tetris
game. It's so good. It's so funny. I just wrote a piece for Life Hacker about a bunch of, because the Game Boy system just launched on Nintendo Switch Online, so they're like, it's kind of like Netflix for Nintendo games, and I included Tetris in this as one of the games you have to play, and I like brought up the sound effects, the soundtrack, because like that's just seared into my memory. It's just like such a like core part of who I am, that specific soundtrack. It's great. And yeah, I mean, I've had video game. I had the Phoenix Wright cell phone jingle for years and years and years on my phone, and it's you know, half my friends have the Metal Gear Solid like alert sound as their text message and stuff. And it's just like, it just transfers over, right? To bringing it into, you know, your day-to-day life in a way that, you know, is so unique to video games. You know, nobody has, movie sound effects as their ringtone, right? But, you know, video games are just so like kind of, I don't even know what the word is.
It's like it's almost like you know, people will get tattoos of something that's important to them, and a ringtone is almost an audio tattoo in a way, where you're announcing, "Hey, this is something that's important to me that helps define who I am."
Yeah, you wait for that moment for your like phone to go off, and then somebody else to be like, you know, their head to pop up and be like, "Who's that?" Like, you know, they like Metal Gear Solid too, right? It's like, you know, identifies you as sort of a like, you know, your like interests, and brings people together over those shared things that they love.
Oh, I love that so much. I love that we're already in the weeds about this, but before we go any further, where can we find you online? What's your website? What's your social media handles? Where can my listeners find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the best and easiest place to find me, unfortunately, is Twitter. It seems like it stabilized there. You know, we went through a few months where it was like, is it going to be around tomorrow? I'm still not entirely sure. Like everything's breaking still, but that's the best place to find me. I'm too active. So I'm on Twitter at A Dribble of Ink. So that was the name of my blog, ADRIBBLEOFINK. You can find me there. You can search for me as well. I am legacy verified. There are, if you search my name, you might find a few different accounts, but I am the verified one as well. That's the best place to find me. I have a website, an author website at aidenmoher.com. And my book, which we'll talk about as well, has a website, at fightmagicitems.rocks. So like Fight Magic Items Rocks. And that's like a one pager that is everything you need to know about the book that I put out back in October. So those are the sort of the three primary places where I can be found by people who are enjoying our chat today.
And I absolutely want to talk about the book that you published last October. It is called Fight Magic Items: The History of Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, and the Rise of Japanese RPGs in the West. I was absolutely fascinated when I saw that title. I've played a few RPGs. I've played a few JRPGs. The big thing for me is just how drastically different the Japanese style of video games is from what is traditionally written in the West. And I mean, they have their similarities, of course, and I could get into my opinion, you know, forever. But I want to talk about you and your book. So tell us, how did you get the idea for this? How did you pitch this to a publisher? How did this come from idea in your mind to something physical that we can all read?
Yeah, I mean, the most important part was meeting and finding people who sort of believed in these same stories as me. And so, like, I was very fortunate that, you know, I closed my blog in 2015, and the idea there was I wanted to move into games writing, because science fiction and fantasy books don't, like, it doesn't pay very well. Writing about video games does not pay very well, but it pays noticeably better. So my idea was like, okay, I have a kid now. You know, my career, I had changed jobs. My career has changed. I was like, I want to write a bit less, but earn a bit more, which is a pretty noble goal. So I switched over into games writing, and it's gone well. And one of my first major pieces was for Kotaku, and it was a big, long feature about how there's a generation of science fiction fantasy writers who are just as inspired by the Japanese RPGs they grew up playing as they are by, like, you know, fantasy books or, you know, Tolkien and Le Guin. You know, they're just as inspired by Hironobu Sakaguchi, Yuji Horii. So I wrote this. I spoke to a ton of authors about their experiences, how Japanese RPGs sort of informed, you know, the books that we love. So I took, you know, Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir has been like a huge book, you know, very popular. Sort of in the pop culture zeitgeist, and that one ties back very heavily to the author's love of Japanese RPGs. And so we spoke at length about that, and the feature really took off. It got a ton of really, really positive feedback, and I received a lot of messages from people, you know, fans and readers being like, oh, wow, like, I love Japanese RPGs. It's so cool to see some of my favorite authors love them too. But then I also got a ton of messages from other authors who were reading it, and they were like, why didn't you contact me? Like, I would have loved to have talked to you for this feature. So I was like, oh, you know what? Like, there's something there. Like, you know, we have this generation of kids. Like, I'm an older millennial, an elder millennial. I'm 39. And I'm, you know, I'm among the first group of people who have just grown up with video games as part of my life. Like, they've just always existed. And so, like, as soon as, like, something like that exists, it shapes you in a way that is just as legitimate as the way books and music and film, theater shape other people. And I saw that, like, firsthand as I worked on this feature and then put it out into the world. And so I was like, you know what, there's something there. There's a group of people here who want to read about these things that existed for them as kids and look at them through an adult perspective. And so I started pitching ideas around that. And so I covered a lot of Japanese RPGs that I love, but also through the angle of, like, okay, like, you know, the elder millennials who are playing these as 12-year-olds are now in their, you know, late 30s, and, you know, we're the ones that are sort of, you know, in the midst of our careers, right? We're the ones, and the people, like, in my age group are the ones that are now running game studios. And so it was like looking at it through this lens of, like, how did these games shape what we're experiencing now and the people that we've become? And so I wrote a few different features about that, places like Uncanny and Electronic Gaming Monthly. And an author and agent named Eric Smith, who I was friends with on Twitter already. He loves Japanese RPGs. And at one point he was like, hey, dude, like, where's the book? When are you going to send me a book about this? And I was like, well, I don't know. And so we got talking. And the idea at first was to collect some of my features and put them together into a collection. But it wasn't the narrative thread wasn't there. And so we kept talking. I was like, well, what if we did this? History of Japanese RPGs. Take the idea and the tone and the approach that I put into my features, which is, like, you know, like, I don't think memoir is quite the right word, but it's very personal look back. It's about the emotions that we have as we play these, about how we're shaped by the experiences we have in these worlds, and apply that to, like, the history of Japanese RPGs. But very specifically, I wanted to look at, like, how these kind of strange Japanese games crafted very specifically for, like, Japanese children, to take you know, a Dungeons and Dragons experience and bring it into their living room TV. Like, you know, it was made for Japanese children. Like, how did it become such a huge phenomenon in the West? What led to that? And then, so, you know, we started that ball getting rolling, and we looked at the story, and it's like, yeah, this is a very fascinating story about cultural exchange, about how Dungeons and Dragons existed in the late 60s and 70s. That inspired people like Richard Garriott to make Ultima. It inspired the creators of Wizardry, and Wizardry and Ultima then inspired Hironobu Sakaguchi and Yuji Horii across the world to create Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy. And then Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest become big, and then they inspire Western creators to create games, you know, that we're seeing now, like games like Chained Echoes or Sea of Stars, which are very heavily inspired by the Japanese RPGs the creators played as kids. And so there's this like cyclical sort of cultural exchange that became the heart and soul of like the book and the story and the journey of Japanese RPGs as they came to prominence in the West. And so we kind of took that all together and found a good through line, which was Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, the two sort of originators, and the book sort of weaves in and out of their stories and looks at the, you know, the history of those games, how they came over to the West, and then what they sort of spawned, and looking at the games that were inspired by them and the games that then went on to inspire later parts of Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, and what the creators are doing now as their careers are winding down, and how their careers have inspired that next generation of creator. So yeah, it was pretty like, you know, connecting with an agent, Eric, who loved this stuff, and then finding the right editor, who was Brit at Running Press, who loves the games as much as we did, and had that passion to bring that story forward in a way that was really sort of engaging and deep and personal. Because, you know, like a lot of history books are, like I very specifically didn't want something that was, you know, like felt like it was just regurgitating a Wikipedia page about the genre. I wanted something that felt like it was like personal. You know, I wanted it to feel like the reader was sitting across like a table at a bar with me, and we're just talking about our favorite games. And that's kind of been the feedback that I've gotten from a lot of readers. So I feel really good about that, you know, that it feels personal, and people saying like, you know, I didn't play these specific games, but I know the exact feelings that you're talking about. I have the same memories of you, but, you know, instead of Chrono Trigger, mine is Phantasy Star 4, you know, or one person saying like, oh, like, you know, one review, he said, like, you know, my friends were all into beat 'em ups and fighting games, but like this book shows me like an alternate universe where my friends were into Japanese RPGs, and that was what we came together around on Saturday nights. And so that was really gratifying, seeing how, you know, this idea I had that, like, you know, these feelings and these emotions, these experiences I had were not unique. They're like shared by hundreds of thousands, millions of people around North America, but also, you know, in Europe and Japan and all over the world. And the specifics might be different, but the end result is the same. And that's fascinating to me.
It's a generational experience, I think, what you've just described. And
absolutely. I think that's a great way to phrase it.
And I don't know how many months of research and work you just distilled down into about 7 minutes.
To be honest, I wrote the book very fast. I wrote it in about 3 months, 3.5 months. And that included a lot of the research at the time as well. Yeah. So like, and that's another, like, because I was able to draw on like personal experience, you know, because like the story focused on Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, but also like, you know, my personal experience and perspective and the experience and perspectives of the people that I interviewed, you know, it came together very fast, and we had a deadline we wanted to hit. But yeah, it was about 3.5 months of writing and research at the same time. And it was not easy on me and my family. But at the same time, being like so fully immersed in like this genre and this history during those 3.5 months for that first draft was very rewarding. And you know, then you bring it together and you do revisions and you edit and it gets slimmed down and stuff. And then it became this really kind of tight, polished story. But yeah, no, it was a very quick process, which was not something I would probably do again, but my experience, as a player and as like a games journalist allowed me to kind of have a very aggressive timeline, which worked out well for the book.
Yeah,
it's out there now.
3 to 4 months is absolutely unreal.
Yeah, it was aggressive for sure. And it's a big book. I think the first draft was about 122,000 words. We edited it down to about 110. And so it's a big book. It was like, yeah, I was writing a lot every day. But at the same time, you know, like, again, like having so much of the history in my head and being able to like find the emotional beat through my own personal perspective helped that come together in a way that, like, something like, I have other book pitches that I'm working on and they're much more reported. It's like, I don't have that personal experience. So, like, you know, my agent and I were talking about one follow-up book and he's like, yeah, I think this is a really great idea. I think there's something here. And I said, yeah, but, like, I need a year just to get the pitch done. Like, I need to talk to, you know, a dozen people just to get, like, a pitch and an outline. And so, like, that's a different experience. I couldn't write that book in 3.5 months, but, like, the immersion for my whole life in this world of, you know, Japanese RPGs allowed me to hit that that timeline. And you know, I look at the book and I read the book now, and I very vividly remember reading that and what I was feeling and how all of that sort of coalesced into the emotion you find in the book and the stories in the anecdotes you find in the book.
You're listening to Retro Rockets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Today's guest is Aidan Mower, author of Fight Magic Items. You can find show notes and other episodes at retrorocketspodcast.podbean.com. While you were writing the book, while you were deciding what was going to make the final draft and what wasn't, did you fall down any really fun rabbit holes?
Yeah, I discovered one of, like, my very favorite consoles, like, of all time now, which is wild. And it didn't even make the book. And that's the Sega Saturn. And so one of the things, so I had a big outline. And like you say, like, you know, I put everything in the kitchen sink in there. And then, you know, through discussions with my editors and beta readers and stuff, it's like, okay, like, the book couldn't be about every single Japanese RPG of, like, all time, right? It would have been 7 million pages long. I would have loved to have written it, but it couldn't be that. So it's like, okay, there's this focus on Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, and then the rise of Japanese RPGs in the West. So every chapter, every topic sort of had to tie back into one of those three things. But during my research, like, one thing that I really discovered that surprised me as, like, a really, like, committed Japanese RPG player in the late 90s was the Sega Saturn was, like, an incredible Japanese RPG system. Just not in North America, because it flopped over here. But it was a huge success financially and critically in Japan. And there's so many good Japanese RPGs. And there's, like, the best versions of some classic Japanese RPGs from my youth that exist on the Sega Saturn that just never made it over here. And so, like, Grandia has a really great version, Lunar, Suikoden. Like, they all have these enhanced, like, better versions for the Saturn, but we only ever got the PlayStation ones. And so I fell down that Saturn rabbit hole, like, real deep. And, you know, like, ordered a Japanese Saturn. Like, I own a Japanese Sega Saturn. Got it, like, modded so that it can use, like, an optical disc drive, so I have access to, like, all these Japanese games. And there's, like, a really robust fan community that's translated a lot of these games or ported the English translations from the PlayStation games into the Saturn versions. So you can, like, you can play Grandia on your Sega Saturn in English now, and same with Lunar and stuff like that. So it's, like, it's been really cool seeing, like, this whole, like, basically, it's like, what would you do if you found, like, a treasure trove of lost PlayStation era Japanese RPGs? And it's like, well, you can. It's like, it's right there. And so that was really fun. But ultimately, because the console was a flop in the West, it didn't really fit the narrative. Like, it didn't really support the rise of Japanese RPGs in the West, because it didn't launch any, like, really successful Japanese RPGs. And its best, you know, its best releases, like Panzer Dragoon Saga, it's like, I think it was, like, there's 25,000 copies printed in English or something, like, minuscule.
Like, that's nothing.
It's nothing. And so now it costs $1,200, but, like, that didn't move. It's an interesting story, but it didn't move the needle for the genre in the West. So that, you know, like, that was an chapter that I had outlined. It was going to be a big chapter, but ultimately, talking to my editor, it's like, okay, this doesn't really support that main narrative. So it had to go. But I was really fortunate to then get to write a feature for Unwinnable, which is a monthly video game magazine about the Sega Saturn and its impact on Japanese RPGs. So I was able to find a way that, like, you know, those stories that fascinated me as I was researching and writing the book, but didn't fit the book, I found a way for quite a few of them now to find new homes, you know, because they were always good stories. They just weren't the right story for the book. So it's like, you know, finding the right editor to help me tell that story to the public has been really fascinating. And another one is just, I published this, like, a week ago, for Washington Post, and it's a deep dive into localization and translation in the 90s, as the genre was going from the sort of, like, little niche genre where it would, like, every like Japanese RPGs would sell 600,000 copies. Like that was that like that was it. Like there are 600,000 people in the West, in North America, who would play Japanese RPGs. They'd buy everyone. But then Final Fantasy VII comes out and sells like 10 million copies, right? Like just like
I remember that numbers.
And it blew up. And so like in Japan, like, and it famously has a poor English localization. And so I went and reached out to the people who were there working on those games and talked to them about like, like what happened? Why did Final Fantasy VII, with this huge marketing budget and all the success, why did it have a bad translation? And then what happened after that? Because starting with Final Fantasy VIII, and then especially by the end of the PlayStation, our console lifespan, you had some incredible localizations. And so there's this guy named Richard Honeywood and another person named Alexander O. Smith and their team of localizers who were able to like sort of fight tooth and nail to reimagine what games localization was in the 90s. And like we owe so much to this, you know, small group of people, Honeywood and Smith and a few others that like really were committed to convincing the Japanese developers and creators and publishers to like really put the effort into to making games localization like a, you know, a robust part of the development cycle. And now you know, games localization is a huge industry, and there's incredible people working in it, and it's like it's a really important part of games because they are cross-national. But you know, going back then, like, you know, they were describing to me about how, like, you know, back then you would be working in flat text files, you'd have no context for where the stuff was in the game. They were like, they'd use a VCR, they'd have like, they'd play through the game with a VCR, and the only way to like revisit a scene was like rewinding the VCR to find it.
And oh my gosh, rewinding a tape. Yeah, do kids even know what that means now?
No, I mean, they know the rewind button, but I can tell you my four-year-old doesn't know what rewind means, right? She knows it means go backwards in the show, but yeah. And like when you think like how long could a VCR, like a VHS, hold? A couple of hours, right? A few hours. But like Final Fantasy VII, if you play it like
it's what 100 200 place, hours, like,
I mean, my original save was 80, I think. Yeah, so like, you know,
how many, like, VCR tapes is that? If a VCR tape only holds, I don't know what, 4 or 5 hours?
Yeah.
That's so like, a stack of VCR tapes.
A stack of VCR and VHS tapes, right? Like, and they were like, then that's, they have to go like VCR, pop the tape in, find that scene so they could get context to translate it in a flat file. And now, like, you know, they helped introduce and create tools now that have made the whole situation of localizing games much, much more advanced and better now. And it's, you know, it's thanks to these people. And so that was a story as well that, like, you know, I put time into in the book, and there is like these stories do come up during certain chapters, but there was so much left over to tell. And so I was able to find a way to, you know, turn that into a freelance, like a feature, and pitch that. And it found a home at Washington Post. And it's one of my favorite things I've ever written. It stands alone just so nicely and shows like that transformative time in the late 90s for the genre that's so important to the book.
So I usually save this question until the very end, but I have to ask it right now. When's the next book coming out? Because you have so much passion and so much love and just so much emotion wrapped up in this. Yeah. You are writing a follow-up, right?
Yeah, I'm right. So I did just sign a contract for another book. It's like, it is, people who like Fight Magic Items, there's a lot that they'll like about this book as well. I can't say anything about it. And then I have, like I said, I've got a few other outlines and pitch documents that my agent and I are working on, and one of them has been sort of sent around, and so we're looking at what to work next. There's so many ideas, right? And that's the trick. But all of them, and like, you know, everyone that I have in my head, like, is something that I think fans of Fight Magic Items will like. That same idea of looking into like I like to say Fight Magic Items is the history of Japanese RPGs and the people who made them. And like, to me, it's always about people. Like, stories are always about people. And so like Fight Magic Items is like, it's about video games, but it's about the people who make them and play them and were inspired by them. And the other books are very similar in that nature and covering similar areas of, you know, pop culture. And I'm excited. I think that they all have a lot of promise. And like I said, I signed a contract for one, so we'll get news on that sometime before the end of the year, which I'm excited about as well. It's coming along. It's about half finished, so happy about that.
I'm very, very excited to hear that. I was so hoping you were going to say, yes, there's more coming. I want to real quick go back to something that you had said real early in the interview that caught my attention because it's something I'm a fan of. And this ties back into our generation. I'm just a couple years older than you. So our generation, we grew up playing these games. Our kids are playing these games. People who are publishing fiction right now grew up playing these games. You happened to mention that the author of Gideon the Ninth was very influenced by JRPGs. I recently reread Gideon the Ninth. It is one of my favorite recent sci-fi, fantasy, something, necromancers. I love everything about it. I absolutely find all of the Locked Tomb artwork on Twitter. So it's anything you want to say about that, and just you know, how is our generation's experience growing up playing these games affecting how we write fiction?
Yeah. So I mean, like, I wrote a whole Kotaku feature about that, which I think is really worth seeking out. So, like, you know, if people are interested in that, like, go dig into that. It was like 10,000 words. So it's like, you know, I could talk about it for the entire duration of this podcast. But I think, like, the key for me and what I saw, like, speaking to Tamsin about Gideon the Ninth, and this was a few years ago before she had published and written the rest of them. But talking about Gideon the Ninth and talking to these other authors, and then my own personal experience is like the understanding and the acceptance that, like you were saying earlier, can't remember if that was on air or off, but like a lot of people grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and games were not accepted as, like, you know, an okay thing to spend time on, right? So like a lot of people were like fighting through their parents, like, you know, dissatisfaction with the fact that their kids were playing video games or whatever, right? And so I think a lot of us have internalized that. And I grew up in a household where it was very accepted. And like, I was given lots of space to play 90-hour Japanese RPGs and hide in my bedroom for 10 hours a day during summer vacation. My parents gave me that space. But even then, like, as I moved on to, like, you know, becoming a fiction writer, like, these games had a huge impact on me, right? Like, yeah, it's impossible for them not to, right? They're big epic stories that are full of emotion, and one of the unique things about video games is you're active within those stories. You're not a passive observer like a book or a film. You're an active participant in that. A lot of them, you know, you have and make active choices that impact the storylines, or at the very least, you know, like, you get to pick your favorite characters, right? So, like, you know, you're playing Final Fantasy VI and you get to fill your party with your favorite characters. Like, can you imagine an epic fantasy book where you got to pick which guys and you know, adventurers and gals went on the adventure? Like, from a party of 15 people? And
that's not a thing.
No, it's not, right? But video games can do that. And that inspired me, right? And that inspired a lot of people. And for me, like, the big freeing thing was realizing, like, oh, okay, I can, like, I'm allowed to let that influence me. I'm allowed to let that show in my work. I'm allowed to be proud of the fact that, like, you know, if I'm pitching the work in progress novel that I'm working on, like, it's cool and it's okay to say that this is, like, you know, this cross Final Fantasy. Or this is, like, you know, this has airships like Final Fantasy does. Or, like, you know, like, and that's totally okay, because not only are the writers inspired by these, but, like, the editors are too, right? Like, so my editor at Running Press, Britt, like, she, like, loves Japanese RPGs. She adores Kingdom Hearts, right? And so, like, and, you know, and she works on fiction books. And so if somebody comes in and they've been inspired by this just as much as other books that they've read, like, that's legit. And there's, like, you know, you can take that emotion and that experience of, like, loving these video games and find what works from them. And I'm not, you know, not, maybe not mechanically, that might not work. Like, I don't want to write a book where, like, people are going to the item shop and, like, you know, it's counting down how much gold pieces they have and equipping their stuff. But, like, you take the spirit of that, right? You take the spirit of, like, you know, like a run and gun, like, or a ragtag group of, like, you know, rebels who all of a sudden the empire's on their back and they straggle into a new town and they have to, like, figure out from their resources, like, how can we leave this town a little bit stronger than we entered, so that we can get on to the next challenge, and, you know, like, that kind of stuff. Like, you know, structurally, you can take ideas, like, of conflict within video games that has sort of that active role of, like, you know, trying to, like, pursue victory over whatever, but also just emotionally, like, you look at Final Fantasy VII and it has this whole theme of, like, you know, life and what we owe the planet, right? And that's something that, like, you know, Final Fantasy VII was, like, way ahead of its time in the way that it was like
it's anti-capitalist, like a cli-fi.
Yeah, yeah,
before that term existed.
From 1997. Yeah, it's remarkable. I replayed it while I was writing the book, and I was like, this game was from 1997. I'm like, oh, that's why I'm like legitimately, like Final Fantasy VII has a huge like impact on why, like, you know, I'm fairly anti-capitalist, I think. Like, because like, how could it not? It had these hugely anti-capitalist, like kind of cli-fi like themes running through it, and I'm like 12. Like, of course that's going to impact me, right? Like, I see Shinra, like, literally sucking the lifeblood out of the planet for profit, and I want to take him down. Like, of course, like, you know, now that I'm 39, I look around, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, Shinra wasn't a fictional company. It was an amalgamation of, you know, capitalism in our current world. And, you know, and so, like, allowing yourself to be like, oh, yeah, I was inspired by this, and it's okay for my work to be inspired by that, I think is something that's been really freeing for our generation to say, like, oh, no, our parents were wrong. Video games were worth our time. And here's the art that we're going to produce to prove it. I think is just very liberating. And that's something that I had to learn the hard way. I pushed against it a lot. The novel I'm working on was like, at first I really tried to shoehorn it into like, oh, it's got to be like, you know, Games of Thronesies. but then I had a talk with some people, like industry people, and they were like, no, like, you know, if you love these video games and you want it to be like more, you know, this or that or whatever, like write that book, write what inspires you.
Right. Yeah.
Let it be influenced by what influenced you. And that'll be a better book in the long run. And now, you know, through my work as a games journalist, I've seen how there's a huge readership for books that are, you know, touched on by those, because the readers are impacted and influenced by video games just as much as I am.
Gosh, I think I just realized like where my environmentalism came from. Of, you know, being in high school, and I wasn't a huge gamer in high school, but I enjoyed watching my friends playing all these games. I loved the emotion. I loved the music. I loved the look on my friends' faces while they were playing these games. Mm-hmm. And those memories are now bubbling all up, and I'm realizing this is where a lot of my life philosophies came from.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's what you want to capture, mm-hmm. right? That's what mm-hmm. I think people who are inspired and are creating new art want to capture, those mm-hmm. feelings, those emotions. That's what I wanted to capture in Fight Magic Items, was to remind people what that felt like back in, you know, when they were a teenager. You know, and, you know, it's a book that's also, there's a lot of information and a lot of like reporting and a lot of interviews and a lot of quotations and stuff, like an actual factual, like historical data in there for people who, you know, maybe weren't around by then. But for those people, I want them to know, like, what was it like growing up at a time when like Japanese RPGs went from like, you know, niche genre to like superstar status. And a lot of it is exactly what you're talking about, that kind of wonder that we had as we played through them as 12-year-olds or 15-year-olds or whatever.
That's fantastic.
I was like the older sibling. And so like me and my youngest brother, who's about 5 years younger than me, have that. He was the one sitting and watching me, because I was like 13. He was 8. Right. So like he wasn't old enough to play some of these Japanese RPGs, but he'd sit in my room for hours. And like we still talk about that. Right. Like for him, that experience was as you know, as real as it was for me. I was holding the controller, but he can flash back to like specific moments in games that he was watching me play, and like, you know, remember exactly what we were saying at the time. Or we have in jokes and running jokes that are 25 years old now, based on like, you know, that experience of my 8-year-old brother sitting and watching me play Japanese RPGs.
Yeah, and I was on my end, I was for the most part, I was the watcher. And something I loved about it was the emotion that I was feeling, the emotion that the player was feeling. And I vividly remember that emotion was often carried through the soundtrack of the game. And that's a huge influence on Western games, is the Japanese games would just have these amazing musical soundtracks. Mm-hmm. And Western games have that now, but back in the day, I don't feel like they did.
Yeah. What I think was really interesting about Japanese RPG soundtracks at the time was how, like, especially the Square stuff was very focused on like leitmotif and like recurring character themes, right? And so you had something like Final Fantasy VI, and every character, like the moment their theme started, it told you exactly who they needed to be and exactly who they wanted to be. And so, you know, there were no, you know, so then you had like, you know, whenever it, you'd hear a leitmotif, or you'd hear like kind of a repetitive like portion of a character theme show up in a different song. You know, in Japanese RPGs, you're like, oh, okay, this scene is about that person. These are the emotions. These are the, you know, the conflicts that we're dealing with here. One of the like remarkable things that I found out working on my book, Fight Magic Items, is like Final Fantasy VI, which was released as Final Fantasy III in the West. It's like known for its character themes. Like, you know, like it has a huge cast of characters. They each have very, very distinctive themes. And they range from like this like spaghetti Western cross, like, samurai theme for like someone like Shadow to like, you know, very kind of ethereal, you know, and uplifting for somebody like Realm. But the composer Nobuo Uematsu actually wrote all of the character themes by themselves. Like, so he didn't take the characters and write them a theme. He wrote a bunch of character themes and then applied them all to the characters after the fact, which I found
like
fascinating.
Very backwards, but just but that's not the right word.
So well, they feel so perfect. Like I can't imagine any other theme for somebody like Locke or somebody like Terra than what they got. But I also think about how different, you know, Locke, who is like, he's an adventurer, a thief, a treasure hunter. And he's kind of like one of the, like, the game doesn't quite have a main character, but he's one of them. And like, I think about how, like, how would his story, how would his character have been different if his theme had been swapped with Shadows, which is like, you know, this kind of more mysterious, like spaghetti Western, like it would have fit an adventure, right?
But it wouldn't have fit him as a person.
It wouldn't have fit him. But it would have changed who you thought he was, right? Rather than the sort of like cavalier, you know, adventurer who sort of like, you know, you find out later on in the game that like he used to have this very close relationship with another like a woman, and she you know, fell down a hole and went into a coma, and then he sort of struck out and became this like very individualistic person. Shadow, on the other hand, like he abandoned his family and he's very individualistic as well. But you know, like they're just their songs. Like if you had swapped that to Locke, like Shadow's theme would work for Locke's character, but he'd be very different, right? And Shadow would have a very different feel if he had Locke's theme, despite the core of their characters being somewhat similar, pushing out you know, closeness with the people around them, the people important to them because of the trauma of their past. They're very similar characters, but their themes make them come across as so different. And the fact that Uematsu just wrote all these themes and then just sort of hodgepodge gave them the characters is just like, I just can't
imagine
even wrap my head around that.
Right. Like imagine the different experience we would have had as, you know, when we're experiencing this character and this sound. Just with different, I'm very affected by music and very affected by audio. So just the idea of a character having a completely different melody.
Yeah.
Like is very,
Yeah. Isn't that wild to think about? Yes. And like video games and especially like those early Japanese RPGs, like leading up, like, you know, even through the PlayStation era, but like they're very, you know, metaphorical, symbolic. Like they use these character sprites that represent like a person. The worlds are very much, you know, like created to like give you an impression that you then translate in your brain, right? Yeah. In a lot of ways, they're like books like that. They don't give you literal action. They give you staged, you know, iconography that tells you what's happening, and it all happens in your head. And music is just so important for that because it's a way that they can convey emotion, like little silly little sprite characters, you know, with very few animations on static backgrounds can only do so much, right? But music can transport people and it can transport emotion and feeling to a player in scenes that need that. And I think that 16-bit RPGs were so good at that. And it's, in some ways, I kind of feel like Japanese RPGs have lost a bit of their identity because like they all just have these sort of big sweeping symphonic scores now. They're not really like melody driven anymore.
I still like them though. I love that symphonic feeling. Yeah.
Sure. But you know, is it that different than Assassin's Creed, you know, or God of War, you know, like,
I think it depends on the mindset that you start with. Sure. Something, I don't know if maybe you've already had this conversation with your younger brother. I don't know. But if you haven't, please do ask him if he ever fell asleep while you were playing.
Oh, that's interesting.
And what he dreamed of listening to that music.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. I can't remember him ever, but I could see that happening because we would play at night. That's interesting.
Yeah. I've got to say that is a very strange hobby of mine, purposely falling asleep to very specific video game music. And yeah, what am I dreaming? Because I'm already thinking about that character. I'm already thinking about that story. I'm already thinking about the emotions wrapped up in what I've been watching.
Yeah. It kind of unlocks things that you've internalized or you're internalizing that you might not necessarily feel in your foreconscious. Subconscious.
We should, I guess, you know, like, we should have like dictionary.com up while we're doing
One thing that I want to actually also go back on that fascinates me about music is like how young some of these people were, not just the creators and like developers and stuff, but like Yasunori Mitsuda, who is well known and considered one of the greatest like game composers of all time. And he's written some of like the all time classics. Like he was like in his early 20s when he did Chrono Trigger. So he was like a sound engineer on games like Final Fantasy V, and he basically went to his boss at Square, Sakaguchi, and he's like, listen, I'm going to quit unless you give me a game. And Sakaguchi was like, yeah, sure, you can do Chrono Trigger. And like, and you know, like, and just, I mean, first off, a corporate environment where some young 20-year-old sound engineer is like, hey, you have to give me a game or I'm going to quit. And then the big boss, the legendary boss, goes, oh, yeah, sure, you can have this game that just turns out to become this legendary game. Like, you know, it's kind of wild, that creative process. But like, you know, he was 21 or 22 when he did Chrono Trigger. And it's like, you know, regularly you'll find it in the top 10.
Like, what were we doing when we were that age? I was not doing anything impressive at that age.
And then Chrono Cross, he was a few years older, but still in his 20s. And like, I think back to my 20s and I was like, I wasn't like accomplishing very much.
Me neither.
You know,
Me neither.
Then like, you know, so you have these people, like these young people in there, like just creating. And I think that creative environment is just so fascinating. There were no rules. There were no blueprints. It wasn't yet kind of clogged down by sort of like the corporate structure that video games are under now, right? And so you had somebody who like you could give a really young, inexperienced composer a chance and they could like blow you away with some of the best soundtracks of all time. What an incredible creative like environment that was at that time for these people who like, you know, nowadays you have games and they're being created by, you know, people who grew up playing them. And for the book that I'm working on that I'm writing right now, I was speaking or reading an interview with a creator of a popular Japanese RPG series. And they were saying like one of the challenges now is like you have to bring in younger workers, right? But those younger workers are, you know, they're the ones that grew up playing these games. And so like they have ideas of what Japanese RPGs should do. They have feelings that they want to convey. Whereas you go back to the 90s when
it was the Wild West,
making this music and making these games, it was Wild West, and they had no idea. And they were laying down the brickwork for the roads, right? They weren't following roads laid before them. And so I think that like, you know, when it comes to music, you had people that just like, you know, they were geniuses, but they were also given the free rein to create our expectations. And I think that that's just really fascinating. You don't get that anymore.
I was going to ask, does that free rein not really exist anymore in your opinion?
Well, I think that now, I think for a long time it started to disappear, but I think crowdfunding and the indie scene has kind of reinvigorated it in that way. I think it's like, if you go back to a lot of the older interviews, a lot of the people like working on games in the 8-bit era, like for like the NES or the Master System or 16-bit era, they'll talk a lot about creative limitations and how challenging it was to work with these like really low powered game consoles, but also how like creative limitations also inspire great creativity and they give guidelines. And so you work within those guidelines and so you don't get like the sprawl. And I think like a big challenge for games now is you can pretty much do anything you want. There aren't really technical limitations, right? At least not compared to the 90s or the 80s. But that's also like really challenging in its own way, right? And so you have to set guidelines. You have to make sure you're managing scope creep and stuff. But I think we're seeing with like crowdfunding and the indie scene, you're seeing smaller projects that just by their nature have to set tighter limitations. And so you're seeing, you know, like you're seeing, I think, a bit more of that creeping in because you have games that don't necessarily have to sell 5 million copies to be successful anymore. You can have something like, you know, a game like Chained Echoes, which is a Western created Japanese RPG that came out late last year. And it's incredible. And it like wears all of its influences on its sleeve, but it was basically created by one person. So, you know, in terms of music, he did hire a composer. So the music was made by a composer, but otherwise, like, you know, he, besides outsourcing some art, like it was all his vision. And so like that couldn't have existed 10 years ago. Right. But now with crowdfunding and developer tools and you know, indie scene, the indie scene being what it is, you have this environment where I think we're getting back to like some of what made like the 80s and 90s so fascinating, that you can have small teams, you could have like really tight visions, you could have games that didn't need to be AAA blockbusters, right? They didn't need to be the Avengers. They could be, you know, like
they
the space
could be
now
something
for
small.
Like, yeah, exactly. You know, I think that that's really important for video games, right? There, you know, you can get the Banshees of Inisherin of video games now, but like 10 years ago, you couldn't. Everything had to be the Avengers, right? And I think that that's really going to change. And I'm really hopeful for like the future of video games because of the indie scene and the way that fans can support creators directly instead of, you know, having to be funneled down into like only the big, huge releases. So in that way, I think we're in a really, really good place to allow some of that, like, you know, creative ambition to like bubble up. And see more like, you know, I don't want to say like auteurs, but like the same idea of like people with like really strong visions allowed to like execute on them and given the freedom and space to do that.
That is so fantastic. What are some of your favorite games that have either come out recently or come out a while ago that you've really been enjoying playing?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a meme that I talk a lot about Chrono Trigger. Chrono Trigger is like my favorite game of all time. And it's like, I talk about it a lot in the book in terms of the way that it sort of like took me from somebody who like, you know, liked Japanese RPGs, somebody who was like obsessed with them. And so, you know, I'm constantly writing about and playing Chrono Trigger. It's just very formative text in my life. And so that's a good one. I've Chained Echoes, which I just mentioned, kind of blew me away at the end of last year. So it's, you know, this pixel art Japanese RPG that like very obviously and openly takes inspiration from a lot of the Golden Age classics. You see the Final Fantasy stuff in there, you see Chrono Trigger stuff in there, you see Xenogears and all sorts of stuff in there, which is really cool. And it's like 30 hours long. It's really like, has no right to be as good as it was, like created by one person with like, you know, so often homage just falls apart because it can't be its own thing. But this, like, I don't know how he did it, but like, it feels like, you know, created by so many things that I love, but it also feels like its own thing, and its quality holds up, you know, from beginning to end. It's just really polished. It's like, it's remarkable that it exists. So that's one that I've, you know, really been enjoying, or really enjoyed. I finished it a few weeks ago. And then I've been playing Persona 4 again, which is really good. I like the Persona series a lot. It's interesting to go back to a game that was released like in the mid-aughts because culturally a lot has changed. And so like, there's a lot of issues like with sort of like cultural conservatism because, you know, it was created by Japanese creators in like 2005, say 2006. I don't know when they were writing it. So, you know, like we've come a long way and the world has changed and culturally like what's acceptable has changed. And so there's, you know, storylines in there about, you know, like some potentially queer characters that are just like, I play it now and I'm like, how did I, like this is not okay. And so you have to recognize within the context that like, yeah, this was created in the mid-aughts in Japan, like by, you know, creators in Japan where, you know, like the acceptance of like
they were
people just like,
yeah, they were creating it under a different context than where we live right now.
Yeah. And so it's like, exactly. And it's hard from that modern perspective, but it's also interesting to look at it through this lens of like, oh, like, look how far the world has changed. And like, you know, yeah, like, are they, you know, did they handle this well? No, but is this like the best they could do within the context? Were they trying to like bridge a gap and create like something that like at the time would have been a respectful way of like saying like, hey, these characters are queer. We can't quite tell you and confirm you like, yeah, for sure, Kanji is gay. But hey, like, you know.
It was what were they allowed to say at the time? So it's also a real interesting snapshot. Into the time.
Very interesting snapshot. Yeah. So it's like, you know, as somebody who can go back and replay it and be like, oh, wow, like, I can't believe that, like, some of this stuff was okay. It's really icky now. But I have the context to be like, oh, yeah, but this was also 15 years ago. You know, the world's changed. I can't expect something from 15 years ago necessarily to be, like, you know, up to 2022 standards. But you also have to be willing to wade through some icky stuff, right? Mm-hmm. To experience a game that, like, you know, you otherwise really enjoy. And so that's been a really interesting experience for me. You know, there's some movies that I love that I'll never go back and watch again.
Because they just have not aged
because
well.
I know they won't hold up, right? Yeah. I love them, but I know that they won't hold up. And so, like, there's definitely stuff like that in Persona where I'm like, wow, like, this really doesn't hold up. But, like, but what was the purpose? What was the context? What were they trying to do here that maybe in 2023, like, falls apart, but, like, in 20... or 2007, maybe it was like, you know,
maybe it worked in 2007.
Yeah. And I don't have the answer to that. Like, I don't know. I'd be interested to see people. And, you know, and after this, maybe I'll go look for some updated sort of like writing about like the handling of the queer characters in Persona 4 through that perspective. But it is interesting to go back to favorites, especially ones like Persona that are like very much based like on real world culture, like that one is. So yeah, I've been playing. I mean, there's lots of good games coming out right now. Too many.
There, yeah, it is. 2023 is shaping up to be a very good year for games.
Yeah, a ridiculous year. Octopath Traveler 2 comes out next week, from when we're recording this, and I'm excited for that. But then, like, Nintendo just like Shadow Drop Metroid Prime Remastered, and it's like, but I just also bought a PlayStation 5, so it's like I have a huge library of that. I hadn't even caught up with the PlayStation 4 library, so it's just it's a dailish. Need more time. I'm at that place in my life, you know, where when I was a teenager, it was like, oh, I couldn't afford, you know, I would have to replay games, or I'd have to play Final Fantasy VIII for like 90 hours because I couldn't afford or get another game until my birthday or whatever. And now it's sort of the opposite problem where it's like, you know, I can afford to buy the games as they come out, but I don't have time to play them. And it's like, which problem is worse? I don't know.
It's like we finally have the funding, but we don't have the time.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it's juggling. Can't complain too much. Too many games is a good problem to have.
Yes, this is a very good problem to have. Yeah. Aiden, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon. This was just a magnificent conversation for me to be a part of. So thank you for being my guest.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been so great to finally actually connect on like a project. And, you know, we've lived inside the same fandom spheres for literally ever, and getting to talk about old games and books and stuff with a friend is just always a pleasure.
Yeah, that's wonderful. As we wrap up, let us know again, where can we find you online? What's your website? Where can we learn more about your book? What's your social media?
Yeah, so the best place to learn about the book is I built a website for it. It's fightmagicitems.rocks. So like Fight Magic Items Rocks. It's a one pager. It has everything you need. It has excerpts from the book. It has links to reviews. It has links to other interviews and podcasts that I've done. It has links to purchase the book through, online vendors, but it also can help you find an indie bookstore in your area where you could pick up the book. I always try to push people towards indie bookstores because we need to support indie, but also a lot of the time, in my experience, when somebody goes in and says, hey, can you special order this book for me? They go, oh yeah, that's cool. I'll bring in two more for the shelves. And so, you know, it's a good way to support authors as well through indie bookstores, and the website will help you find that. I have my regular author website, aidenmoher.com. Best place to find me online though is Twitter, as long as it's a thing, at a dribble of ink, ADRIBBLEOFINK.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.